And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
In the first half of today's Sixers beat, Rich and I discuss Dave Yeager and his addition to the coaching staff and the new additions to the front office in Peter Dinwiddie, Prosper Kurangwa, and Jameer Nelson. In the second half of the podcast, we bring on Jovan Buha, who covers the Clippers for The Athletic, to give his thoughts on Doc Rivers and his fit with the Sixers. Enjoy the podcast. All right, welcome everybody. This is Derek Bonner, joined by Rich Hoffman on the Sixers beat, a part of the Athletics Podcast Network. How you doing, Rich?
I'm okay, man. We got some stuff to talk about.
There has been some additions to the Sixers coaching and front office staff. I guess real quick, right at the top, head on over to theathletic.com/Sixers beat. You can get a yearly subscription for $1 a month. Still promo, still running. $1 a month. Lowest it's ever been. I might be a tiny bit biased, but I think, let me put it this way. If I wasn't writing for The Athletic, I would pay $1 a month to go read Rich Hoffman. So go check that out.
Go do it. We got some good stuff coming. Come on. $1. That's not hard.
And let's be honest, even if we don't have good stuff coming, if we only have marginal stuff coming, it's still only $1.
It's $12. Who cares?
Head on over there. If you've been on the fence for a while, if you know of Rich and I from the past, if you like what you hear on this podcast, head on over there. This is the best deal you'll ever get for The Athletic. And not only do you get me, myself, and Rich, but you get, you know, Shiel Kapadia and Beau Wolf and Zach Berman and Charlie, who's a machine, and Matt Gelb and Megan
and every other sporting team you want.
Yeah. Anything you want, we have it pretty much covered in the sporting realm. So head on over there, check it out. A great deal available now. All right, Sixers staffing updates. You know, I think when we had last recorded, Doc Rivers had obviously been hired. We'd gotten a little bit of time to digest that. Not a whole lot of changes outside of that. I don't think there was a single member of his coaching staff that was added up to that point. I don't think there was any changes in the front office officially. So we have, I guess we'll start off with the coaching staff, and we're going to keep this one relatively short. We have a Jovan Buha, who covers the Clippers for The Athletic, which you can also read his stuff for $1 a month. Head on over there.
He's in the package, too.
He's included. He'll be on the second half of this podcast to sort of give us his perspective on the Doc Rivers era there, since he covered him. So we'll keep this pretty short, but a quick rundown, and then we can get into specifics. Dave Yeager, somebody we had talked about as a potential head coaching candidate, hired as an assistant coach. Peter Dinwiddie, hired from the Indiana Pacers to be essentially Elton Brand's second in command, executive vice president of basketball operations, which, if that title sounds familiar, yes, there is somebody on the staff who currently has that title. We'll get into that as well. And then Prosper Kurangwa, hired from the Orlando Magic to be the director of scouting. Did I get those job titles correct? I didn't write them down. I probably should.
I don't know if you got the job titles right, but I'm impressed that you got Prosper Kurangwa, the name. I don't know if you got
impressed. We went over this right before the podcast to make sure we had it right.
Well, I don't know if you got it right, but you certainly got through it smoothly. So that's the big thing. I forget what Prosper. I don't know if his job title has been. It's definitely a scouting position of some sort. That is where he came from. But Dinwiddie, yes, he is the executive vice president of basketball operations. The number two for.
Kurangwa is the vice president of player personnel. My apologies.
These titles are pretty funny, by the way.
Oh, they can be completely made up. They don't actually represent the role. Yeah.
John Hollinger, who worked in the Grizzlies front office, he has some very good insight and jokes on how made up these titles can be at times.
I mean, right now Ned Cohen is still listed as the assistant general manager, and nobody really knows what his role is right now, because you read Peter Dinwiddie's profile and you read Ned Cohen's profile, and there's a lot of overlap there.
Definitely.
So yeah, these job titles don't necessarily mean too much.
So who are we starting with? Yeagerbaum?
Yes, let's go with the... And I guess if you're curious, Jaeger, spelled what? J-O-E-R-G-E-R, pronounced Jaeger, like Jaeger, or like a Jaeger bomb. When Woj broke it, that was a Jaeger bomb. Yep.
Ugh, couldn't do Jaeger bombs, man. I was always bad.
I was never a huge fan. There's a pretty funny meme out there, though, with Dave Jaeger as a Jaeger bomb, which I'm sure we will use once or twice for every opportunity we get.
Yeah, I will be making that joke all year. If the Sixers make a big defensive stop, Jaeger bomb. And I guess we don't know yet what exactly Jaeger's specialty on this coaching staff will be. I believe Keith Pompey reported that it's defense, but Doc has not come out and said that.
That was sort of his role with the Grizzlies before he took over, right?
Mm-hmm. That was his role.
But he also then grew into one of the league's probably better ATO play designers, so he can certainly do both. He probably has a little more background on the defensive side, though.
Yeah, it's funny. When I looked at his background, I kind of was more interested in the offense, but it was pointed out to me that in, I believe it was 2011, 2012, he was the defensive coordinator in Memphis, as Chris Broussard once famously wrote. And they were the second-ranked defense in the league that season, obviously had great personnel. And, they were basically the first-ranked defense. I mean, Indiana, they were neck and neck.
And as our good friend John Hollinger, who doesn't have any reason to be biased at all, pointed out the East was a JV conference back then.
It was true. It's pretty bad. So, you know, it seems like that could be where he is slotted. I mean, it would make sense. Doc Rivers on his staffs tends to give the defense to somebody, whether that's Tom Thibodeau, it was Rex Kalamian with the Clippers, whatever. That is a big position. I like this hire. What do you think about it?
Almost nobody you talk to has a concern about Dave Jaeger's basketball intellect. Like, I think everybody praises him really highly, to be honest. There's a lot of concern in terms of his ability to sort of manage the relationships both up and down the totem pole. Like, there's been a lot of conflict with him and upper management, which could make this team interesting, but we'll get into that later. And also then there was some concern in Sacramento in terms of dealing with sort of the expectations of his young players and letting them sort of play through their mistakes. Both Marvin Bagley, Buddy Hield, they're sort of the two main ones, but it seemed like it was a pretty common complaint, or at least concern, and not only inconsistent role, but also then communicating that role. That being said, if he's here as a essentially defensive coordinator, that doesn't really matter nearly as much. That's Doc's job to worry about. He doesn't have to worry up or down nearly as much. He has to worry a little more with the coaching staff and getting them to execute. But no, in terms of, like, if he's going to come here and be focused on helping the team execute and be the best they can be, I think he's a good... I mean, look, I had interest in him as a head coach. And those concerns that I just talked about were much larger when you're talking about a guy who has to run a team like that. In this role, I think he will be good.
I agree. He certainly seems to rub people the wrong way in different stops, like you said, up and down.
He's very concerned about his job security. That's a very recurring theme, which I get. Like, in Memphis, there were rumors that they wanted to fire him like 5 games into the season. Well, if that happens early on, it's like a relationship. If you get scarred early on, it's tough to not be worried about that later on. And let's be honest, like, early para-era Grizzlies and the Kings, not exactly the most well-run, not model franchises to be working for. So you don't really know whether or not he's... just a little paranoid or whether there's really something there. But yeah, for sure.
I would also add, like, he did not have, he had some run-ins with Buddy Hield. It's not like that stopped when he left,
So. No, and that's something that hasn't, like, I think the Sixers fans are so like, yay, a shooter wants us. Well, but like, why does he keep getting angry at coaches? Like, it's a fair concern.
The Buddy Hield discussion will be one we can have in a couple weeks when free agency starts to come around. I've been listening to a few pods. There have been some pretty negative takes about him, which have been interesting. But let's get back to Jaeger. Yeah, so certainly the interpersonal stuff seems like that would be more of a concern for the head coach. I mean, obviously, like, he's going to be interacting with players. You can't have him be a complete ass. But
no, but you have Doc who can maybe smooth some of that over.
Yeah, and the one thing I will say, like, you talked about job security with Jaeger, I do appreciate that Doc, if anything, has the clout and security to hire an experienced coach like Dave Yeager. Like right. the old Mark Jackson thing where he wanted no-name coaches because he didn't want to be threatened. And Joe Lacob was all over him because he was like, why are we, you know, not to say these guys are terrible, but why not try and shoot a little higher with these assistant coaches? Doc clearly doesn't care about that. He obviously was very well compensated by the Sixers. The worst thing that he sees looking over his shoulder is a Brinks truck, you know, if he does get fired. So, and Doc had a very high opinion of him. I had this in our story last week, but I remember listening to the Woj pod with him and Spoelstra, and Woj asked him, hey, is there anybody who's under the radar, whether, like, you know, his team's not good enough or, you know, for whatever reason, just doesn't get maybe the shine as a coach? And both Doc and Spoelstra said Yeager. And I do like that he has coached multiple styles of teams, even if the Memphis teams were, I mean, let's be honest, they were a little bit gross. I love, you know, how tough they were. I appreciate the physicality and that those teams seemed to they were overachievers in some sense of the words. I did not really enjoy watching those teams play, though.
As opposed to the clean style of basketball the Sixers are built to play?
Yeah, I mean, hey, like, you know, it's kind of like he understands how it is to work with poor sure. spacing. Yeah, for sure. It's not like we're watching pretty basketball here, though. That's a great point. And to have that, which kind of seems like Embiid's world, and then to have the Kings teams with De'Aaron Fox that were faster than any team in the league, I think, in 18-19. And then he got fired for kind of the interpersonal relationships.
He got fired. Vlade got a 4-year extension. And then a year later, Vlade was fired.
Yeah. So Kings. Look, I mean, it's true. Like you can look at him and say, I'm not sure what this guy is, you know, a behind the scenes type of guy. But to be fair, as you said, the Kings and the Grizzlies, not the most stable situations in the world. So
do you remember that whole like Robert Parra, Jason Levien, like that Eric Grizzlies? There was some weird infighting going on there. Yeah.
Yeah. So as an assistant coach, though, I think this is a great hire because basically everybody who you talk to around the league, even people who, you know, might have had like run-ins with him, they will concede that on game days and with X's and O's and schemes and things like that, he's pretty good. He's well thought of in that regard. I'm sure he views this as an opportunity to launch back into a head coaching job sure. at some point. You know, let's say the Sixers make the finals. He'll become, you know, the hot coaching candidate who turned this thing around. So yeah, overall, I think it's a pretty good first hire for Doc. We'll see what he does with the rest of his staff. You know, you got Sam Cassell and all these other people with some jobs still. I guess Houston's the only job still open. Is that right?
Sounds right, yeah.
Yeah.
Pelicans so maybe, just hired Stan.
Maybe they're waiting on that. Stan got hired in New Orleans. Yeah, so, you know, again, like, am I doing backflips for this? No, but I think it's a pretty good hire.
Can you do a backflip? That would be impressive. If we just, like, found out that Rich can do a backflip.
That's a great point. I cannot do a backflip. I always thought I was a pretty good athlete, but I was never... It's never like that flexible, you know? Well, I had good like hand-eye coordination, but not that type of athleticism with the backflips.
I never had the guts to try it. Like, do I know that I can do a backflip? No, because I'm not stupid enough to try it.
I would like to see you try it. Well, maybe we'll do that. We'll film it. We'll both try it, and we'll have to go to the hospital.
I don't know if being
6'2
is the right body build to be... Well, 6'2 and 38 years old is the right body makeup to be doing backflips, but...
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll put that one on the back burner. All right, moving on to the front office. And there was another addition, Jameer Nelson as a scout and assistant GM of the Delaware Bluecoats, which I didn't mention.
That's a lower level one, but I'm not going to lie.
Which is interesting. Like, that dude was just doing podcasts like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Look, and that's a lower level addition. It kind of reminds me, EB was the GM of the Bluecoats at that point. But it does kind of remind me a little bit of just like this very well-respected player jumping in to the front office side. And I mean, you know, you heard me cheering. I don't think any basketball fan in Philadelphia, there is like anybody who follows college basketball, no player has a higher Q rating than Jameer Nelson. And you know, I don't know how he'll be at this, but I would like him to be good because I am a big fan of his.
Yeah, for all the people making the joke that he is now one stop away from being the Sixers GM, no, he's two stops away. He first needs to get promoted to 87ers, or 87ers, Blue Coach GM, and then he can be the Sixers GM. The 87ers GM, by the way, has had a couple people who have been promoted pretty highly in the NBA. Brandon Williams, of course, then moving on to the Sacramento Kings, where he had a run-in with Dave Yeager, tying this full circle. But yeah, no, Jameer is, I can't, like, as a concept, like sort of like the homegrown, we got to promote the former player who the fans love thing. I'm a little skeptical because a lot of times it doesn't work out. Jameer is a good guy. I just growing up, like watching that St. Joe's team was one of my favorite. I was in college at the time. Watching them was great. He is certainly, you know, you listen to him talk about the game. He certainly has a good understanding of the game. Give him a shot at that level, see what he can do. And, good for him. I'm excited to see how it works out. Moving on to the other front office additions, though. Peter Dinwiddie. He was previously the third in command, I believe, with the Pacers. A former sales guy, which the Sixers have always had interest in sales guys going over to the basketball side. He has made the jump, has been there for quite a while, really mentored by Donnie Walsh, who was previously with the Knicks before going over to the Pacers. A lot of rave reviews from Walsh, from Larry Bird. Really seems like they respect what he was able to do, respect how hard of a worker he is, clearly knows the salary cap extremely well, which is probably what people cite most often. Involved in a lot of contract negotiations. Seems like he will be a good addition to the staff. And then Prosper Kurongwa, which, do you know exactly what he was involved with in terms of scouting with the Magic? No, that's always sort of like the rub with grading these guys. You don't know what he recommended the GM and was overruled on, or what decisions were made that he was against. Orlando's had an up and down track record in terms of the draft. You know, I think the Victor Oladipo, Domantas Sabonis picks were really good. They didn't give them enough time to develop in Orlando. That's not a scouting mistake, though. The Mo Bamba pick obviously has been a disappointment. And then Jonathan Isaac, I think, has shown a lot of promise, but he has been injured quite a bit. So I think they've had some hits, some misses, as most scouting departments do. But, you know, we'll see.
So I have two thoughts on this. The first thing, and this is kind of a more organizational thought, is that it is officially Elton Brand's show. Left the door open for a president of basketball operations. Daryl Morey did quit his job in Houston, which, you know, maybe raised some eyebrows for half a second.
Which, by the way, the reporting is that decision has been known around NBA circles for weeks before he officially did it. So the Sixers probably would have known that he would have been available for quite a while now.
Yep. And, you know, while Daryl said, or Fertitta or somebody said that maybe he'll end up on the East Coast, does not seem like that is going to be in Philadelphia this year. Elton Brand is making the hires. And this, to me, screams, you know, regardless, I mean, Dinwiddie is, you know, the team is basically off the record kind of said, like, yeah, he's the number two person. And then Kurongwa is going to play a big part in the scouting. So this strikes me as Elton kind of bringing in his people. That's yep. The first thing I would say.
Yep.
The second thing I would say is just talking to the people in Indiana and Orlando. Look, I imagine that anytime people leave an organization, there are going to be rave reviews for these people. Like, you know, take it with a grain of salt. You know, obviously this doesn't mean they're going to kill it in Philadelphia. But from talking to the people in both of those organizations, they got two people who are really well-liked. You know, Dinwiddie, pretty cool story. Rose up from ticket sales to the front office. Looks like Jonah from Veep a little bit. Cap guy. Good relationships around the league. You know, well-respected, all that jazz. You know, obviously a very well-run organization with limited financial resources.
And limited not only in financial resources, but also just as a destination for free agents. Like even, you know, disregarding the cap flexibility, it's a tough place to lure people to play.
Yeah, those two things often go hand in hand. Not always. Oklahoma City's spent on the tax sometimes. And then Kurongwa, former college player. I will have a story on those two. TheAthletic.com/SixersBeat, $1. Pay for it, please. And I talked to a lot of people about him, and
this story will be worth at least 50 cents.
Sure. Yeah, you'll be halfway there.
Then, yeah, exactly.
And he's got a cool story where, you know, the Magic, they kind of hired him from running his own scouting service. He started that up, and he has just risen up their organization, and they speak really highly of him. I would just say with, like, Elton, too, it screams to me that, like, he actually was thorough with this search, bringing in two people from very different backgrounds, very different teams. It seems like he came into here or into this search talking to a bunch of different people around the league, and these are the two people that he found. So look, like, I still have plenty of concerns of Elton getting the job for obvious reasons that we have talked about, but from what I can tell, they allowed him to go out and hire his own guys, and it seems like he did a decent amount of homework, and he came back with two people he trusts. So good for him. Now, does this mean if they make shitty draft picks, trades, free agent signings, that we won't be all over them? Of course not. There is still a ton of pressure in this market, and the Sixers are in a bad spot. But the process here seems to be okay to me, better than last time. Although that is a low bar.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Yeah, no, I think a couple things. We got to get going here because we are making Jovan wait. I think the hirings are reasonable to good for what they are. Like, if you're looking for a number two to come in, be sort of like your cap guy, be a negotiator, be a contacts guy. Like, Peter Dinwiddie seems like he's more than qualified to fill that role. He seems like he's well-respected, well-liked. It seems like he has earned that opportunity. And Prosper, I think, same thing in terms of what he's asked to do. I think that's fair. I think if you have concerns about this front office, I think they're threefold. First of all, is Elton Brand experienced enough where he can aggregate sort of all of these opinions and make the final decisions? That's really what you want from a GM. Like, your GM doesn't have to be the cap guy. He doesn't have to be the analytics guy. He doesn't even have to be a scouting guy. He has to be able to aggregate all of the different opinions in that organization, know what to value, know what to weight, know who to trust, know whose area of expertise fits what, and be able to sort of combine everyone else's skill set and knowledge into one decision. And look, he's still the most inexperienced GM in the league, and there's no getting around that. Two, will management and ownership give him the leeway and the purview to run his own ship? And I think clearly there should be some hesitation and worry around that. And if those two aren't true, then sort of who you add as your cap guy doesn't really matter all that much. And then three, which we sort of haven't even gotten to, but is how he kicked off this. So you had Alex Rucker, who was your number two in your organization. He was essentially an analytics guy who got promoted to become much more of a basketball decision maker. He's now being demoted and might end up being just an analytics guy before. Does that indicate that Elton Brand isn't going to value analytics as highly as he should? And, you know, he essentially started this offseason by saying that we had to add more basketball minds. It is interesting he went out and then hired Peter Dinwiddie as number two, since he does not have a traditional basketball background. I don't care about that too much. I don't believe, like I wrote in my article the other day, I don't believe you have to have the genetics to play NBA basketball to be a good basketball mind, but it is, I mean, that's what he said. He said basketball minds, and Dinwiddie is not that. But more importantly, since they demoted their analytics guy and haven't made any changes to their analytics guys, are they devaluing analytics? And I think a lot of people will look at it and say, look, Alex Rucker was essentially the number two in the organization. He was an analytics background. He clearly wasn't using analytics correctly, or the Sixers were not built using a good application of analytics. And that can be true. I don't think that means you then go and say the Sixers relied too heavily on analytics. I think you say we need to figure out how we can use analytics to make more informed decisions. And I'm not convinced Elton Brand sort of has that kind of mindset. And I do worry. I don't think this is a game. Every team in the league uses analytics to some degree. between the demotion of Rucker and moving on from Sergi Oliva, who was essentially like he took analytics and applied it to the coaching staff and helped them with rotations and strategies. I'm a little worried that their view is this roster might be better than it was. We don't have to make major fundamental changes. We relied too heavily on analytics. Let's fix all that with the coaching staff, with less of a reliance on analytics. And I don't think that's the approach to take. And those are my concerns. And it's really nothing to do with Peter Dinwiddie or Prosper Kurangwa. And like you said, I give Brand some credit because it does seem like this is thorough. But I still have my concerns, and they're quite frankly pretty big concerns.
Yeah, but those are bigger, more overarching concerns than the top people under Elton Brand. And we will just have to see how that plays out in the coming months.
All right. That sounds good. Thank you, Rich, for jumping on. And we'll be back on in a second with Jovan Buha. All right. We are now joined by Jovan Buha, who covers the Clippers for The Athletic. So we figured it would be a good time to bring you on as someone who covered Doc Rivers previously and give us sort of like a little bit of a rundown of what your thoughts are with him. So I guess we'll just start it off, especially since you guys had such high expectations out there to start the season and when you entered the bubble. After the sort of collapse happened, were you surprised that they went in a different direction?
I was, and so were people internally with the Clippers. You know, all the conversations I had had with people inside and outside, but close to the organization, had suggested that they felt Doc was going to get another year. That was the expectation. And even if you look at how it kind of went down, you know, they didn't part ways with him for 2 weeks after. And most of the time you have a disappointing loss like that, the coach is fired the next day or within a few days or maybe even a week tops. But, you know, this was something that the Clippers thought about hard. And, it took several conversations between Steve Ballmer and Doc Rivers for them to ultimately decide that. I know from Doc's side, he felt a bit surprised and, was not necessarily expecting this. So, the Clippers framed it as a mutual parting of ways, but it sounds like from what's been reported on Doc's side that he did not feel it was mutual. But I think it was, as I reported a couple weeks ago, just this perfect storm of a lot of different things not going the Clippers' way. All season they had a bunch of injuries. They were one of the most injured playoff teams. You combine Kawhi Leonard's load management, and they just never really had that on-court chemistry or continuity, not to mention some of the locker room stuff. And then you get to the bubble, and finally everybody's healthy, and then they have seven guys either arrive late or leave the bubble at some point, including, multiple starters, multiple key bench guys. So, you look at all those factors and it makes sense why this team came up short. But I do think some of that is on Doc, though. And some of the decisions he made, refusing to play Ivica Zubac more, continuing to play Montrezl Harrell over him in spite of all the data and the eye test and everything kind of pointing in Zubac's favor. Stuff like that, I think you can put on Doc, but overall it was a kind of perfect storm for the Clippers to collapse and come up short. And I think Doc has kind of been painted as the scapegoat in the aftermath of everything.
So I'm curious about that chemistry you brought up, Jovan. You and Sam Amick, you had a story about the team's chemistry. I believe it was like back in January or so, middle of the season. Just like some warning signs about how, maybe this was a little bit different from a team that the year before seemed like the chemistry was great. They overachieved, but they also didn't have the expectations of winning a championship. So I'm kind of curious about that because it felt to me from the outside like a team that just, it wasn't necessarily on the same page at all times, but the on-court result for most of the regular season, I mean, this was a dominant team. They were, they were top five in offense and defense, I think. It seemed like they, for a team that was kind of going through the motions in some ways, maybe like pacing themselves for the playoffs, and that's obviously a big thing with Kawhi Leonard. It seemed like things, at least, the final product, like it seemed like it was okay. So I guess I'm a little bit curious about, you have the holdovers from last year. That's Montrezl Harrell, Lou Williams, all of these guys. You have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George coming in. What was Doc's role in maybe trying to figure out that chemistry. And do you think he fell short in some aspects there?
I think Doc was in a tough position because looking at the situation, you know, on paper, it made a lot of sense, right? You had this team from the 2018-19 season that overachieved, made the playoffs. You had guys like Lou Williams, Patrick Beverley, Montrezl Harrell stepping up. You know, they were basically cast-offs from that Houston deal, right? Like they were basically throw-ins for Chris Paul, guys who you kind of viewed as bench guys, maybe low-end starters. And you know, really looking at that Clippers team, I think most people picked them to finish 12th or 13th in the West, and no one saw them making the playoffs. So for them to have that season, and you know, Danilo Gallinari was part of that, Tobias Harris, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, you know, different guys, but those three specifically, you know, they were what the Clippers got in the Chris Paul trade, and they kind of became the face of the team. But you add Kawhi Leonard and Paul George to that, and again, on paper, it makes sense. This looks like a contender. It looks like all the pieces fit, but you know, actually fitting that together in the locker room is much more difficult. And I think the Clippers might have, you know, overestimated how easy that transition period is going to be, because I think in Kawhi Leonard and Paul George, you have two guys who are not vocal leaders, and you know, they will admit that. The Clippers will admit that. You know, Ty Lue admitted it yesterday. Like they're more lead by example guys, but I think the guys like Lou Williams, Patrick Beverley, who were more of those vocal leaders a couple years ago, felt displaced because you had Kawhi and PG getting preferential treatment and getting that star treatment. And it just kind of created a little bit of a divide in the locker room. And it wasn't, you know, this wasn't Kobe, Shaq or Russell Westbrook, KD, where you actually had real beef. But there was some tension. And, you know, with the nature of a lot of the guys on this roster, there was a tendency to go quiet and not talk to each other and not actually talk things out and resolve it. So as far as Doc, you know, he was kind of forced to step in as the vocal leader, both publicly and privately. You know, he basically was the voice of the team. It wasn't Kawhi. It wasn't PG. And then internally, he would have to, you know, bring up some of those conversations or try to talk to one guy to resolve something and then go talk to the other guy to resolve it. And I think Doc was just in a lose-lose situation because you obviously have to placate your stars to some extent and keep them happy. But then he also couldn't do that too much and risk losing the role players. So I think it was really a juggling act that he never fully figured out. And I do think that's going to be one of the bigger challenges of him stepping into Philly because, you know, I don't think it's the same situation, but it does seem like there are some similarities in terms of just personality conflict and not everyone being on the same page. And, you know, this is now really his second tenure or second kind of era of a team having that, right? Because you had the same thing in Lob City. So I am interested to see how he handles it in Philly.
So you had, I think the general perception of Doc from afar is that he sort of sets a really good base strategy, and then there's a little bit of concern whether or not he can adjust in the playoffs. And I mean, the 3-3-1 losses are going to be at the top of that. But like, just judging based off of what you said earlier in his game day adjustments, how much did you see carryover in his previous seasons and previous era with the Clippers, which would you know, give you some pause, I guess?
I think that you hit the nail on the head. It is, from a base strategy, Doc is one of the best coaches in the league. Like, you know, and even from talking to people around the league after his departure, there were people that I spoke with that said, you know, they feel it might be a mistake. Like, yes, you know, he did not adjust well in the playoffs. You can make the case he didn't adjust well in the 2015 playoffs when they blew that 3-1 lead against Houston. But you have to have a 3-1 lead to blow a 3-1 lead. And you know, Doc's track record is proven of he'll get you 50 to 55 wins and into the second round. And, you know, while that might not be what the Clippers wanted and that might not be what the Sixers want, you know, that still is tough to do. And not every coach in the league can almost guarantee that if he has a competent, you know, good roster. So I think from that perspective, Doc is a very good coach. But to your point about adjustments, you know, he mentioned this throughout the season. And at times I wondered if it was lip service, but it clearly was proven not to be. You know, Doc is very stubborn and he believes things should be a certain way with regards to, he likes to run his offense a certain way. He likes to run his defense a certain way. he likes a certain rotation. And once he kind of puts his feet on the ground and says, this is how I'm doing it, he's doesn't like to adjust almost out of principle of just, you know, this is what's worked up to this point. You know, we should be the ones setting the tone. But I think looking back at last year's Clippers team, like one of the things you really liked about that team was that they had the versatility to adjust to their opponents. So, and really outplay them. Like, you know, people talked about them potentially playing Houston, and it was like, if they play Houston, they can go small with a Marcus Morris at center or a Kawhi even at the five and you know, out small ball Houston. But when Doc, you know, when they played them, you know, right before the hiatus, they stayed big and they ended up, you know, crushing the Rockets, but the Rockets ended up, you know, they shot like 15% on threes. They had a really bad shooting night, but kind of the point being was like Doc just refused to adjust to his opponents, which I think you have to find that balance of you don't want to overreact and panic and pull a guy who's playing well, maybe because you don't think it's a good matchup for him. But you also have to be realistic. And, you know, when Nikola Jokic is destroying Montrezl Harrell in the pick and roll, in the post, picking him apart, the Nuggets are crashing the offensive glass. Like, you have to adjust and bench Montrezl Harrell, you know, despite him being the sixth man of the year, despite him maybe being your fourth or fifth best player in the regular season. Like, you have to adjust. Otherwise, you blow a 3-1 lead and blow three consecutive double-digit leads. So I think with Doc, again, like, you know, maybe this experience will be illuminating for him and he'll learn from it. And, you know, maybe he'll be a little bit different in Philly. But I do think there is some concern with he can get you to that 55-win mark. He can get you into the second round. But when it comes to the fine tuning and the adjustments and the counters, that's where my confidence in Doc is a little bit shaky.
Yeah, I don't know how it couldn't be after, you know, he had the roster, like you said, that could play literally every style you wanted. So I think that's fair. In terms of like you being surprised that he was fired, can you just talk about like he had become like more than a coach for that organization? Is that correct? Like over the years, he had become almost like one of the biggest figures just through everything that they had been through and kind of the multiple iterations and all that stuff.
Yeah, he was the Clippers, right? Like, because I mean, Chris Paul and Blake Griffin were the Clippers during Lob City, and now it's Kawhi and PG. But Doc has been that, you know, the through line for the franchise since coming in 2013. And I think that was also another factor in what made it so difficult to part ways with him was that, you know, he led this team through their darkest days of the Donald Sterling tapes, you know, of that 5-day period of, you know, were they going to play against the Warriors? Were they going to boycott that game? You know, was the business part of the operation going to just up and quit and leave and refuse to work for a racist owner? You know, and he handled that chaos beautifully. And I think that helped, you know, earn him a lot of goodwill with the franchise. It made him a larger than life figure. I mean, I think he probably was, aside from Pop, like the biggest figure, you know, the biggest coaching figure for his franchise in the NBA. You know, I can't really think of another coach who had that level of power and gravitas and just, you know, everybody liked Doc. Like no one, you know, I guess some of the players, you know, maybe towards the end weren't his biggest fan. But aside from that, like everyone in the organization liked Doc. Like there's no ill will towards Doc. He is a very charming guy with a lot of gravitas. Just, you know, he almost has that, you know, politician like demeanor to him where, you know, he knows what to say to people. He knows how to make you feel good. And I think you guys will see it with the media. Like he's arguably the best coach in the league with the media, or, you know, top three, top four. So I think that was another factor in this, was that it wasn't just, you know, parting ways with a coach. It was parting way with, and you saw it in the bubble too, like, you know, his you know, speeches on racism and social justice and different stuff going on in society. Like, you know, that it earned him political attention where you know, you had presidents talking about him and, you know, just it was on the news and stuff and CNN and stuff. So it's just like, I think that stuff, you know, made it more complicated because it wasn't just getting, you know, it wasn't just getting rid of a coach, but that was ultimately what the Clippers decided, was like, if his name wasn't Doc Rivers and he had not done all this great stuff off of the court, would we have let go of him maybe a year or two earlier? And I think the answer was yes. So that's ultimately what they decided and why they went in that direction.
You know, I think there's been a little bit of concern here with the Sixers and whether or not they're going to maybe not embrace analytics quite as much. I guess, what can you tell us about Doc, his willingness to sort of work with the front office to adjust his game plan, and his willingness to embrace, embrace analytics into his coaching strategy?
Doc is not the most analytics friendly coach. It was something that I think did frustrate the front office a little bit. In conversations I had, after his departure, again, going back to the Ivica Zubac Montrezl Harrell dynamic, the lineup data in the regular season supported Ivica Zubac over Montrezl Harrell. As our John Hollinger wrote, by lineup data and just kind of advanced metrics, like, Zubac was arguably a top 15 to 20 center in the NBA this season, which no one would expect, right? I mean, when you think about Ivica Zubac, you probably think of, again, a low-end starter, a high-end backup, but you don't think of a guy who's arguably a top 15 center. But that was the case statistically, at least. So, Ivica was always capped at 16, 18 minutes a night. In the bubble, he was kind of thrown into more playing time because Trez missed a month and they didn't have another center option. But it was kind of telling that in game 7, Doc went back to Trez, even though he was the one guy that, no matter who you put him with lineup data wise, the Clippers were always getting destroyed. He had a minus 30 net rating with Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, which is just unfathomable. Like, how do you lose minutes with Kawhi and PG that badly, in the playoffs? So I think, Doc is not someone that values three-pointers. I think it's something I asked him about repeatedly during the season.
Well, he'll fit right in with this roster.
So, I mean, I will say to counter, some of the Doc criticism, his offenses in LA were always top five when he had the talent. So I think he is really good at, I was talking to a former video coordinator and they were explaining it to me. Doc doesn't have a set system and he doesn't have many plays. He's really good at out of bounds plays, sideline out of bounds, out of timeout plays. But what he has are these packages. And if you look at what he was able to do, especially with Lob City, he unlocked JJ Redick. Like the JJ Redick you guys saw in Philly, the JJ Redick we've seen in New Orleans, that was from Doc Rivers really empowering him and saying, JJ, you're a starter. You're going to play 30 to 32 minutes a night. We're going to run, 5 to 7 sets for you every night. We're going to get you open looks. The first play of every game was always a floppy action for JJ coming off that, the left elbow into a jumper. So he did that with JJ, with DeAndre Jordan. He really empowered him in the pick and roll as a roller and getting him involved early in games. So I think Doc, while he isn't going to run the most modern offense, he's not the most progressive or innovative coach, and ultimately that's one of the reasons the Clippers moved on from him. The results are there. Again, this is a guy who can get you 50 to 55 wins, will get you a top 5 or 6 offense, and it might not be the most modern approach, but it is effective. So I think it is going to be interesting. I think he's entering. What's interesting to me about this situation is, again, with the Clippers, he had amassed so much power that really looking at the dynamics, like, you can make the case he was the second most powerful person in the organization behind Steve Ballmer, or at least on par with Lawrence Frank. Whereas entering the Sixers situation, he is obviously, lower in the pecking order behind the head decision makers of the front office. So I think maybe not having as much organizational power could benefit him, and maybe they've already had some of those conversations of like, hey, if we want a certain guy to play more, or we want to see a certain lineup or whatever, like, maybe Doc will be more open to that than he was in the Clippers, where he kind of ran things more. So I would say, he's not the most analytic friendly guy. He's not going to, force passing or force screening or threes or some of the more modern things we've grown accustomed to. But I think, again, the results are there. And I do wonder if maybe a different dynamic will bring out a different version of him.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
That power dynamic is something I'm curious about, because with the Sixers, like you said, he obviously does not have personnel control. He did gain that at some point with the Clippers, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, there was always like the joke around the league that he was, when he did have personnel control, he was like amassing the 2010 Eastern Conference All-Stars or whatever in 2016. So I'm curious, like, he obviously played a big part in getting Kawhi and PG to come there. LA also played a pretty big part, I imagine, too. So can I ask you, like, what was kind of his timeline in terms of, you know, relinquishing that control? Did he still have a lot of say in that front office?
Yeah, so in 2017, that was the shifting year. That was a big year for the Clippers, because that was, the final year of Lob City. They ended up trading away Chris Paul to the Rockets, and they completely tore down the front office. So at that point, Doc was both head coach and president of basketball operations. So they brought in Jerry West right before the draft. And then a couple months later, a month later, Doc was stripped of his title. And then 2 months later, they promoted Lawrence Frank, brought in Michael Winger, Trent Redden, Mark Hughes, completely reshuffled the front office, which now I think has, you know, become one of the better ones in the league if you just look at their track record. But it was also kind of in stark contrast with what Doc had done, which was bringing in, as you said, Eastern Conference veterans that he faced or had on his roster in the early 2010s. So, the thing was, like, Doc and Lawrence are close. Lawrence was on his staff in Boston and LA. So, you know, they are good friends, and I think Doc still carried weight with that. He had a good relationship with Steve Ballmer, so anytime he wanted to speak with him about something, you know, he had that green light. So I think ultimately he lost the power to make final decisions, but he still had a say. And I think, you know, you saw the team improve in terms of their personnel and just some of the moves they made. But Doc still had a say on things. And I just think ultimately, you know, that was one of the things that was, I think, a reason why they moved on was, be it his coaching staff or, some of the lineup and rotation decisions, the front office disagreed. And I don't know if that was, I don't know who directly that was, disagreeing with Doc, but, I keep going back to the Zubats Harrell thing, because that's what I've been told by multiple people. But I think one thing you've seen from the Clipper side with talking about Ty Lue is, you know, they're going to have a say in his coaching staff, and they're going to, you know, they were talking about being better aligned with the coaching staff in terms of just their vision for the team and the roster, better aligning with the front office. So I think reading the tea leaves there, Doc was clearly not on the same page fully with the front office by the end of his tenure. So, I think that's going to be a key for him in Philly, is making sure that his vision aligns with Elton Brand's vision and just kind of the rest of Sixers management, because if not, you know, that's where I think things can go south.
Definitely, and it's something that has gone south at times.
You might not have intended it, but the rest of Sixers management carried a lot of weight in that last answer. Yeah. Sixers have a little bit of a convoluted power structure. Anyway, go ahead, Rich.
Last one I want to know. We have been a little bit skeptical of the idea that he is like the Tobias Harris whisperer. You know, I think Tobias Harris, good player, certainly paid too much for him in a trade, certainly paid too much for him in free agency. But he did have his best, you know, I guess it was like close to a full season, you know, over 2 years with Doc. You know, besides making threes, what did you see that that allowed that Doc did to allow Tobias to play pretty well there?
He ran a lot of elbow sets for Tobias, put him in the pick and roll. And I think this speaks to, there is this reputation with Doc that he doesn't like young guys. He doesn't play them. He won't develop or empower them. And again, I think you've seen the Clippers kind of hint at that with some of the stuff they've said about Ty Lue and how they're excited for his player development. But one thing Doc does really well, which I think you saw with that group a couple years ago, is he does a really good job of playing to guys' strengths and trying to hide their weaknesses. And I think you saw that in LA with Tobias having a near all-star season, Danilo Gallinari having a near all-star season, Pat Bev, Montrezl Harrell, Lou Williams, all playing, you know, career best basketball under Doc. And part of that was the context of just not having a true all-star or star on that team. And, you know, them just kind of being this ragtag group that on any given night could have a different leading scorer. But I also think part of it was, you know, again, looking at like JJ Redick, DeAndre Jordan, like some of these guys, Doc can find ways to unlock and really highlight their strengths. And that's one of the benefits, I think, of him not necessarily having a strong ideology or a system. You know, this isn't Mike D'Antoni where, you know, you have to conform to his system and fit around that. So I think with a guy like Tobias, you know, Doc made him the go-to guy. And I don't anticipate that happening in Philly. You know, I think he's obviously, you know, third or fourth in the pecking order, depending on how you want to look at it. But, you know, I think Doc just he's really good at instilling confidence in guys that he trusts and that he likes. And Tobias clearly was one of those guys. So I do think, you know, you will maybe see him play him with the second unit more, you know, get him going and just make sure Tobias is getting enough touches. You know, I do think there was some fool's gold in it, obviously, where, you know, Tobias just had a crazy shooting season. And, you know, I believe was almost a 50-40-90 guy that season. And really just, you know, I think had a career year. But part of that was also just Doc putting him in the right spots, running, you know, a lot of plays for him on the right elbow, posting him up. You know, the Clippers had a kind of a funky lineup where teams had to pick between Tobias and Gallo of who they were going to put the bigger guy on. And more often than not, they put it on Gallo. So Tobias had a lot of times mismatches with guys that were like 6'4", 6'5". So he was able to post them up and exploit that. But, you know, again, I don't think he's going to go back to that level of play just because I feel like that was just a little bit of fool's gold, a little bit of a career year. But I do think his familiarity with Doc and Doc already trusting him is going to be big. And I could see him, you know, maybe getting back to some of those numbers and looking more like the Clippers version of Tobias.
I guess just one more piggybacking off of Tobias. You know, the Clippers trade him in the midst of a career season. Ostensibly, you don't think he's going to be worth the contract he eventually gets. Sixers give them essentially a godfather offer, and the rest is history. But how much, like, what do you think went into the decision not to keep Tobias Harris around? Obviously, it ended up working out. Like, you use that cap space reasonably well. But how much do you think Doc played a part in that? How much do you think he, you know, was there any trepidation, I guess, of keeping Tobias around long term, and how much was Doc influenced in that?
I don't think Doc was a part of that decision. I think that was entirely on the front office, and I think, from my understanding, they just looked at the landscape of the league and were like, you know, if we get a star next summer, you know, be it Kawhi Leonard, Kevin Durant was a thing for a bit, sure. You know, Jimmy Butler, you know. Could Tobias be that number two on a title team for us? And they ultimately decided no, that you know, that was not the case. So, you know, realistically, he would probably be a number three at best. But given the contract demands and what he was likely going to get, they didn't feel that he was going to get paid as a number three. So they decided that, you know, it is a risk to move on. There's a chance we strike out and don't, you know, end up getting a star or two stars this offseason. But, the worst thing you can do is, you know, pay a guy more than he's worth, especially at that level. You know, it's one thing to maybe pay a guy $7 million when he's worth $2 million, but to pay someone $40 million when maybe they're worth $20 million, like that's where your cap sheet gets crippled. And I'm sure you guys are aware of that. So I think that was more the Clippers thinking. But from Doc, like, you know, Doc wants to win, and obviously losing Tobias on that team, you know, they became a worse team, you know, marginally. It wasn't a big, drop off, but that did decrease their ceiling. So I think Doc, you know, wanted to keep Tobias. I don't know if he wanted to re-sign him necessarily, but I know he wanted to keep him past the deadline. So, I think that was more of a front office thing of just projecting out how they viewed Tobias long-term and deciding he was not a top two guy on a championship team.
Yeah, as I was asking that question, I was trying to remember exactly the Clippers cap situation. I think Tobias had like a 20 mil cap hold, and I think the Clippers would have had enough for one max free agent that offseason, even with his cap hold, but not two or something like that.
Yeah, it was going to get tricky.
Yeah, finances were obviously a big part of that. And yes, we have mentioned the Tobias Harris contract and paying him $40 million once or twice here over the last
couple
year.
Couple times, you know.
Yeah. All right, one more, and then we will let you go, and we appreciate your time. But just generally speaking, knowing Doc, his personality, how he likes to coach, what his strengths and weaknesses are, and what the Sixers roster is, how do you think he fits in with this team and with what they need out of a head coach right now?
I think it's a good fit. I do think ultimately looking at the East, and the level of coaching in the East right now, like I think you could, I would make the case, you know, the level of coaching at the top of the East is better than the level of coaching at the top of the West. Going up against guys like Nick Nurse, Eric Spoelstra, Brad Stevens in the playoffs, like that does give me a little bit of trepidation, just with, you know, like Doc, I mean, Rick Carlisle, I think, is a great coach, but I would make the case Doc was out coached by Rick Carlisle and Mike Malone in consecutive playoff series this postseason. So looking at the names he's going to have to go up against in the East, like that would worry me a little bit. But I think from day one, it's already past day one, but from training camp, I guess, you're going to see him talk up Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons and say, you know, they have the potential to be the best duo in the league. And he's going to say Joel's the best big, the best post scorer. He's going to say Ben's the best passer and you know, the closest thing to LeBron. And he's really going to pump those guys up. So I think for
did
those
you
guys,
know, Jovan, that when those two play, the Sixers win 65% of their games?
I mentioned that
about three times during his intro press conference.
Hey, look, yep. He's in analytics. So he's going to play that game. He plays the media game really well. Like, first thing he said when he got to the Clippers was DeAndre Jordan is, you know, has Bill Russell level potential defensively and should win multiple defensive player of the year. So he's going to play that game. And I know we kind of, you know, scoff at that and laugh at it, but that matters to players. And you know, I think, I don't know ultimately how much it's going to matter to Joel Embiid or Ben Simmons, but like he is going to sing their praises ad nauseum and really just pump up how good they are together. You'll probably hear that number referenced, so I think ultimately, like, I think he's going, you know, he's, I think he's a better coach than Brett Brown. I don't know to what extent, but I do think, you know, one of Doc's best qualities is his ability to get guys to buy in. I think the buy-in might be shorter lived than people want to admit. But again, this was a guy who sold Kawhi Leonard and Paul George on teaming up and coming to the Clippers. This was a guy that really got that Lob City team into a different headspace, I think, initially upon arriving there. This is the guy that they got the Celtics to buy in with the big three. So I think from the beginning, like he's good at getting guys on the same page, getting them to buy in. I just think, you know, that only lasts a season or two based on his track record. So I'm, you know, longer term, I don't really know how good of a fit he's going to be, but I think over the next couple of years, I think you should see a Sixers team that is battling for that, you know, 2-3, you know, 4 seed, in that heavily in that mix, a team that if it goes back to 82 games could win, you know, 54, 55, 56 wins, and get to the second round and maybe even make a conference finals. I just think at the highest levels, based on his last few years in the playoffs and really his inability to keep guys on the same page in the locker room and make adjustments at the highest level, I do have some concern about him actually winning a championship with the Sixers or maybe getting them past the conference finals.
That's fair.
All right. I think that's probably just about all that I have. How are you, Rich?
I'm good, man.
All right. Well, we appreciate this very much. Thank you for jumping on, and best of luck out in LA.
Appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.